Good afternoon. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Polysports, as you can every Wednesday here on Global Patriot Radio. Just come hear us on blogtalkradio.com. Yeah, I love that song. It's a theme to Harry O. I know most of you are too young to remember that show. It was a great show. Loved it. David Jansen. Hey, if you want to contact me off show anytime, you can always do that by emailing at hjpsports1980@gmail.com. Go to Twitter and just type in at hpolysports. Polysports, of course, is spelled P-O-L-I-S-P-O-R-T-S. Not poly like P-O-L-L-Y. No, 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 no. And not poly like P-O-L-Y, which means many. No, poly. P-O-L-I for politics and sports. Absolutely. Oh, go to Facebook and type in Hank Jones Polysports. But as I've said before, I'm not there as often. Anyway, it is Wednesday, May 11th, 2022, or 2022. I don't know. And there's all this stuff about don't say 2022 because it makes it sound like 2020, 2. I don't know. Hey, you know what? This is not the only day. Wednesday is not the only day that we are active here on Global Patriot Radio. Of course, every Monday, the Vito Esposito Show featuring Vito and Big Al. That's 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Tuesdays, Cross and Crescent Discussion, also 6 p.m. Eastern. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern, Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, noon Eastern, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. And then Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, Revealing the Truth About Islam with Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie. And Sundays, Eric's back with Real Interfaith Dialogue at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Great stuff. You know what? There's other shows, too, on Blog Talk Radio. Airwaves America with the Dave and G-Ski Rocks show. Joseph Gibson's in multiple times during the week with understanding the times in which we live. Annie, of course, Southern Sense Radio. And then Tim Tapp with Tap Into Truth. All great stuff across Blog Talk Radio. Some of them also simulcast on other media. Mediums is not a good way to say it. Unless you're talking about, you know, people that are like fortune tellers or whatever. But otherwise, other media. My wife is here in Electric Hank Land. Actually, she's in Acoustic Hank Land over on the other side. And then the little miniature Australian Shepherd has eaten. She jumps out of the gym. I mean, she literally jumps up shoulder high when she's waiting for her food. It's incredible. She went for a walk with us this morning. She was awesome. She was. We could take her into stores, and she's just calm as can be. So anyway, that's what's going on. It's, as I said, Wednesday, and it is May the 11th, 2022. And, typical day in this country. Anyway, they've got the obituaries for the past week. Last Wednesday, a week ago today, we lost Kenny Moore. He was a former Olympian, American Olympian. He was 78. No cause was listed. He ran track and cross country at University of Oregon under the legendary Bill Bowerman. Bill Bowerman is, for those who don't know, he's credited with creating that famous waffle, Nike waffle shoe. Anyway, Kenny Moore won the world's largest foot race. It's called the Beta Breakers. He won it a record 6 consecutive times. He actually led early on in the 1968 Olympic marathon, but he faded to 14th, got blisters, not good. He went on to finish 4th, just out of the medal stand in the 1972 Olympic marathon. If you remember, that's the one, it was won by his American teammate, Frank Shorter. That was the famous imposter race where that jack wagon, who hadn't actually run the race, he just jumped into the course and then ran. He was wearing a West German uniform and ran into Olympic Stadium first. A lot of people at the beginning thought it was the leading runner. Officials finally caught it, got the guy off the track before he could, quote, unquote, complete the race. Yeah, Kenny Moore went on to a long career in journalism, 25-plus years. He wrote for Sports Illustrated. He was a commentator for track and road race stuff on television. He advocated for amateurism in the sport as well as protection for American athletes so that they'd be able to compete on the world stage fairly. 78. Great guy from all accounts. Thursday, we lost Canadian actor Kenneth Welsh at age 80, and we also lost internet personality. Not sure what that means. Anyway, internet personality Kevin Samuels at just 53. Now, he apparently had suffered chest pains the night before, according to a woman with whom he spent the night. He was found unresponsive by her the next day. Kevin Samuels became controversial for his many YouTube and Instagram posts where he derided fellow black men and women who went unmarried. He called unmarried black women over the age of 35, quote unquote, leftover women, and said that something, quote, was likely wrong with them. Detractors said he was using arguments for traditional gender roles to mask intentional advocacy of misogyny. Yeah, whatever. Kenneth Welsh caused a mini controversy when he was playing the United States vice president in the 2004 hilarity film The Day After Tomorrow. I know it was supposed to be a serious commentary on climate change, but it tends to be viewed by normal, rational people as a damn comedy. Because frankly, although it's not actually funny, the drama is laughable. Factuality less accurate than the average daily weather report, and the tragic instances. I'm thinking of, you know, the one, the helicopters freezing in midair and mid-flight. I mean, really more worthy of a Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode than an actual drama. Anyway, he was kind of, by the intent of the crackpot director Roland Emmerich, he was made to look almost identical to then-current Vice President Dick Cheney. Was supposed to reflect Emmerich's view, negative view of the Bush administration's climate policies. Yeah. Oddly enough, my wife and daughter and I saw that movie two nights before the second of three successive hurricanes that hit Central Florida over a six-week span, summer 2004. I got to say, I was pretty disappointed when we didn't get any cinder block-sized hailstones during those storms like we were supposed to, you know, according to the movie. Anyway, I'm going to declare Kevin Samuels to be the bigger loss. Also declaring right now, anyone willing to take up his cause, you got 10 or 15 minutes free on this show anytime. Friday, we lost American rapper / singer Jewel. No, not the semi-hot Canadian country singer, but the American rapper / singer from Death Row Records. Evidently had complications of lung issues. She was only 53. Made her biggest impact as a background vocalist on rap albums by people like Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Tupac Shakur. She was called the first lady of Death Row Records, actually. And then Saturday we lost country singer Mickey Gilley, age 86. He actually had no hits on the pop charts, believe it or not. He did have 17 number one hits on the country music charts, because country being the operative word, no sound bites or any of his songs here on this show. In addition to being the cousin of both Jerry Lee Lewis and Jimmy Swaggart, yikes, he enjoyed early success in the 50s and 60s. Although he was successful also during the 70s, his career was really rejuvenated with the success of the 1980 film Urban Cowboy. A couple of his songs were used in that movie. Don't ask me which ones. I have no idea. Well, Sunday, in addition to celebrating both Mother's Day and Brother Tommy's birthday, we lost Ray Scott to natural causes at the age of 88. Now, in addition to advocating for conservation and boating safety, he made his greatest contribution as the founder of BASS, a.k.a. Bass Anglers Sportsman Society. He went on to create the Bassmaster Tournament Trail, Bassmaster Magazine, Bassmaster's TV show, the Bass Federation. He also helped design and promote less intrusive but functional flotation gear for fishing enthusiasts. And he also advocated for rotational fishing, in other words, not overfishing popular areas to the point of exhausting the fish population in those locales, otherwise known as don't fish the same hole, fishing hole every day. On Monday, in Orlando, Florida, we saw the tragic murder of former Michigan State and NBA player Adrian Payne. He was just 31. According to the accused murderer, Payne had gone to a home to intercede in a domestic dispute. The accused shooter actually turned himself in, and he's pleaded not guilty. Adrian Payne, if you'll remember, he became well-known for his friendship with 8-year-old cancer patient Lacey Holsworth during the 2013 and 14 season. She was at the Michigan State games. She helped Adrian Payne when he was cutting down the nets after they won the Big Ten tournament. She was often highlighted in the stands during their NCAA tournament games. And unfortunately, sadly, she passed away from neuroblastoma in April that year. The story in the investigations, obviously, in the early stages, we'll probably hear more as the situation develops. Then yesterday, we lost former St. Bonaventure and Detroit Pistons legendary center Bob Lanier to a brief illness at 73. He led St. Bonaventure to a 26-0 regular season, a final poll ranking of number 3. And that was in, I don't remember. His junior year, they went 17-7, and he was already getting interest from the old ABA. His father urged him to stay for his senior year, where the Bonnies went 25-1, and again, a number 3 final ranking. He led them to the Final Four that year, but he suffered a knee injury. So that would have been the 1969-70 season in the regional championship. He couldn't play in the Final Four. They lost in the semifinal to NCAA runner-up Jacksonville and their star center, Artis Gilmore. In the third-place game, again, without him, they lost to New Mexico State. They finished that year 28-3. His sophomore and junior years, he was a second-team All-American behind UCLA legend Lou Alcindor, now known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And then his senior season, he was first-team All-American. Get a load of this first team. Bob Lanier at center, Kentucky forward Dan Issel, guards Pete Maravich of LSU, Calvin Murphy of Niagara, and Rick Mount of Purdue. Yeah, tough lineup to crack. Hey, before we get to the news, a shout-out to my friends at Alliance Communications in Central Florida, a 24-hour call center messaging service. Actually, they serve all over the country, actually internationally. And like I've said before, a full range of call center-type services, straightforward after-hours messaging, detailed response services, government accounts, large and small businesses, especially businesses that aren't going back after the pandemic. If you're not returning to your office, but you need someone to handle your calls, give them a call at 800-555-3738. Vito is in the chat room, and I got a couple of friends on the phone lines as well, my buddy Jeff and Sue from New Mexico. Vito, Vito, if you didn't hear, Bob Lanier was second team his junior and senior years behind Kareem, then known as Lou Alcindor. And then his senior year, first team All-America, Dan Issel, Pete Maravich, Calvin Murphy, and Rick Mount. So, yeah, Vito had asked me who, you know, if I'd heard about Bob Lanier and who it was. Yeah, that's who it was. Team. So, anyway, give the gang at Alliance a call, 800-555-3738, or find them on the web, alliancecommunications.com. Okay, three quickies. We'll start with three quickies tonight. Good. This is good news. A judge in New York has ordered the primary to be held in August rather than June, as the Democrats wanted. Remember, a group sought to hold the primary in June when a congressional map that favored it would still be in play. Judge smacked that down. That map was rejected. And then the group attempted to argue that a late August primary would risk disenfranchising voters. Judge called it a Hail Mary pass, It's funny. What the hell does disenfranchised mean anyway? I know what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean just anybody who wants to vote their own personal agenda. I mean, it's no. Yeah, I've got breaking news coming up on my breaking news. Victims of Surfside condo collapse did something. I assume it's filed a lawsuit. Anyway, so that judge ordered that New York City or that New York State prime, in addition to the knocking down the district redistricting map, is forcing the primary to be held in August now. Before I came on to today, during a speech at the White House on Tuesday, believe it or not, I don't hear President Joe Biden's or Dopey Joe's speeches, but he was attempting to address high inflation, but that well. He didn't offer any solutions, of course. He just, his usual gaffes. A reporter was discussing comments that came from Florida Senator Rick Scott, and Florida pointed out, you called out Rick Scott a little while ago in your remarks. He said, I'm just quoting here, the most effective thing Joe Biden can do to solve the inflation crisis is resign. And Biden responded, resign? That's a good idea. He probably thought he was being funny. He also then said Americans don't understand the job he's doing on the economy. God, this guy is truly clueless. And several later people said, and Rick, that Joe Biden is unwell, unfit for office, incoherent, incapacitated, and confused. Guess what? Joe Biden said, I think the man has a problem. I think he is not mentally fit for office currently. Yeah, isn't that good? Yeah, so there's that. And then the acting director of National Institutes of Health admits the appearance of conflicts of interest. Want to know why? Undisclosed royalty payments estimated at $350 million from pharmaceutical and other firms to Dr. Fauci and hundreds of NIH scientists, he says, do present an appearance of a conflict of interest. Really? An appearance, huh? He says, Representative John Molinar from Michigan told the acting director, Lawrence Tabak, you may have very sound reasons, scientific reasons for recommending a medicine or not, but the idea that people get a financial benefit from certain research that's been done and grants that were awarded is the height of the appearance of a conflict of interest. Yeah, so I say that's a definite conflict. Well, okay, Vito just explained disenfranchise is when you own a McDonald's franchise and McDonald's cancels your franchise. That's disenfranchise. Well, he's pretty much right on that one. New York Republican Congressman Tom Reed has resigned, effective immediately, resigned on the House floor today. It wasn't clear yet that it was due to some accusations that came up a couple of years ago. He was accused of sexual misconduct last year. A woman named Nicolette Davis said Reed drunkenly groped her. That was published in the WAPO last month. Oh, that last March. So about a year ago. It was in there since 2010. The redistricting process isn't finished in New York, as I noted earlier, but that district is pretty much guaranteed to remain in the Republican hands. So it's kind of weird that he would, resign when he's in a very safe seat. At the time, he didn't remember the incident, but he took responsibility for disrespecting her. He says, I hear her voice and will not dismiss her. Yeah, good for him. Whatever. As I said, it's a safe GOP district, so it could mean that the party prompted him to resign. That's very possible. I'm not sure if I see this as good or as nonsense. I mean, there's no trial, no admittance of wrongdoing, no congressional inquiry. My last point, this is still a thing. I mean, seriously, we have the White House and the O'Biden-Harris administration doxing Supreme Court justice addresses, staying quiet on the protests, staying quiet on the Supreme Court leak, but this guy somehow makes news and resigns? Yeah, okay. College football, quick. Nebraska head football coach Scott Frost has been hit with some minor penalties. And I'm pulling this from ESPN's website. Basically, he received a one-year show cause order and a five-day suspension. It's to be heard during the championship segment of the 2022 season. Yeah, in other words, they won't be doing anything then anyway. It's part of the penalties for violating NCAA rules regarding countable coaches. At the Level 2 negotiated resolution, they acknowledged that in 2020, former special teams analyst Jonathan Rutledge coached Nebraska players during practices and film sessions and also helped with in-game coaching decisions, which violates NCAA rules for non-coaching staff members. NCAA limits teams to 10 assistants. While many analysts are employed, they are not permitted to provide on-field or in-game instruction. Had their probation extended through April 23rd, received a $10,000 fine, a reduction of countable coaches during two practices this spring, and non-coaching staff for 5 days during the 2022 season. Trev Alberts, their AD, said they've had an outstanding collaboration with the NCAA, and he thanks the NCAA staff for their time and professionalism. Yeah, by the way, I don't think I've really mentioned it. Mark Emmert, the executive director of the NCAA, resigns. It's not effective until next year, which is unfortunate. But anyway, Scott Frost is 15-29 in his time at Nebraska in his four seasons. My comments, what do these penalties even mean? And, you know, given that Kansas just won an NCAA basketball title with level one violations hanging over their head, and it's doubtful, by the way, that anything serious will happen, in my opinion anyway, what is the point of this violation and this penalty? If Nebraska is doing this and still sucking, why do they call it an advantage? And why not look at certain other schools, Bama, and pay a little scrutiny to the multitude of analyst positions that they have? Lastly, are we really going to go after this, but drag our feet, or more likely, more appropriately, drag ass on things like national letter of intent stuff and name, image, and likeness and its obvious use as a recruiting tool? Yeah, probably not. Let's see. Former Florida Congressman Colonel Alan West is going to challenge Wayne LaPierre for leadership the NRA. This is from American Liberty's website. This is kind of interesting. Former Florida Congressman Alan West is no stranger to controversy. The outspoken conservative rose to prominence during the Tea Party wave of 2010. Although he only served one term, his life story as a military officer born and raised in inner city Atlanta and his proven ability to articulate conservative principles made him a force to be reckoned with among the grassroots. Anyway, he was in 2020, he became the leader of the Republican Party of Texas, defeated incumbent James Dickey. However, he was not able to unseat Greg Abbott in the gubernatorial primary. Evidently, he is challenging the leadership of Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre at the National Rifle Association. By the way, he didn't announce it. He was asked to by several. He consented to the nomination. Now, former NRA President David Keene is a little more cynical. He said, Alan West is trying to generate publicity for himself by saying he's going to challenge Wayne LaPierre for the executive vice president's position. Now, Keene claims that West lost his spot on the NRA's board of directors because he's all about Alan and about nothing else. Now, I don't know. A lot of things going on there. They are chartered in New York. They're currently headquartered in Virginia, but they are possibly reincorporating and moving to Texas. Now, they're involved in a legal challenge in New York. Who's trying to the Attorney General Letitia James is pushing for the board, for the NRA to be dissolved. Not really sure on which grounds, but she makes it up as she goes along. Like it or not, Wayne LaPierre's time has come. He did lead the NRA through some crucial times, but he's been around long enough. It's time. And I think Alan West will fight for the NRA. Now, full disclosure, I'm a former NRA member. I am not a current member. Like a lot of national organizations, the organization tends to be, as it gets larger, it tends to be, it tends to become top-heavy and self-protective. They tend to, they have to grow their membership and feed on it just to feed themselves. But I think Alan West would fight for the NRA. And something else it does, it takes the narrative of white gun-toting redneck off the table. Now, I know liberals don't like Alan West because even though he is black, he's conservative. So to them, he's a fake black person. Not sure how they come to that conclusion, but whatever. Does take that narrative off the table. By the way, Wayne LaPierre is not a white gun-toting redneck either. He's white. He probably owns guns, but he's not a redneck. Now, the NCAA has now, their board of directors has come out with some guidelines on NIL and the involvement of boosters. Now, basically, Monday, they published new guidelines clarifying that boosters, and this includes recently created companies designed to provide collectives for endorsement deals, they should not have any contact with athletes or their family members. Basically, they worked with athletic directors and conference commissioners to review the evolving marketplace for college athletes. It updated the rules last summer to allow the NIL, but this is since that time, comes after hugely growing concern that there are boosters and NIL-focused companies that are being formed simply to use money incentives to get athletes to come to a certain school. The new guidelines say that boosters are collective who contact recruits or sign athletes to contracts that are contingent upon a player's attendance at a particular school are breaking NCAA rules. The Division I Board of Directors said the NCAA might pursue sanctions against anyone who has egregiously violated these rules in the past 10 months since the rules were changed, but it is likely to focus more on issues that come up in the future. Said they may pursue the most outrageous violations that were clearly contrary to the interim policy adopted last summer, but the focus is on future. The new guideline establishes a common set of expectations for institutions moving forward, and the board expects all Division I institutions to follow recruiting rules and operate within these reasonable expectations. They don't establish any new rules, but are an attempt to clarify the definition of a booster. Coaches and administrators have called publicly for more help in recent weeks. Yeah, no kidding. I'm going to tell you more about that. Yeah, like I said, an entire industry has emerged out of that whole thing. In addition, Southeast Conference 12, their commissioners went to Congress and want congressional guidelines as well. Now, it's not clear whether they're doing that to circumvent the NCAA or if they're doing it because they felt the NCAA was dragging feet. I don't know. Seriously, though, at what point does the NCAA rein this in? Or more to the point, at what point does Congress, the IRS, and other regulatory-type agencies enter the fray? I think Steve Dace nailed it a couple of years ago when he said, you know, at a certain point, the IRS will get involved because this will become taxable. It's not like a scholarship. These are benefits that aren't available to all athletes and are selective. That's clearly a benefit outside the scope of an athletic or academic scholarship. Players manage it. Can they hire agents to manage it for them? You know, I mean, it's. Here's something from the Conservative Review. It says wages aren't keeping up with inflation. Really? Yeah, really. It says the real wages of America's workforce are falling rapidly. Wage growth is falling farther and farther behind as inflation continues to spiral out of control. Average hourly earnings for employees on private non-farm payrolls rose by only 0.3% in April, lower than what economists were projecting. And according to data released from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, nominal earnings have only increased 5.5% on an annual basis, far below the rate of inflation. Yeah. Oh, the irony. Look how many states either mandated or voted for wage increases the past few years, not to mention municipalities, Seattle. How come nobody, presumably economist types, how come nobody points to that itself as an inflationary cause? You know, when people hear inflation, they think strictly consumers. They don't think businesses. But as an example, I'm just thinking Florida had a minimum wage of $8.25. It was voted to go to $10 on September 30th, so October 1st of 2021. And I think the minimum wage might have been a little like $8.39, but anyway, you know, a huge increase. Percentage-wise. Then, in addition to that provision, it didn't stop there. Every October 1st, the minimum wage increases $1 per hour. So by 2026, it will go to $15 per hour. Now you're saying, you know, that's fair, Hank. I'm not saying that that's, you know, that it's bad to have a living wage. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is when you mandate it, when you artificially boost it, when you don't base it on market conditions, yeah, you have no choice but to face inflation, but to face wage compression at a minimum, if not outright job loss. People, you know, to answer wage compression, basically what occurs in that scenario is not that people don't get minimum wage. It's not that there aren't new hires. What happens is that people on the upper scale, or shouldn't I say the upper, on the next rung, start to have their wages slowed. So somebody who's been getting a 6% increase annually, as some companies do, or 5% or whatever, 3%, those start to shrink. Problem is, guess what? You know, when you can get rid of somebody making $12 an hour who's screwing off because you can pay someone $8.50 an hour, that's one thing. But when you're suddenly having to pay entry-level people $15 an hour, people that are making $16 and $18 an hour aren't going to see an increase, if any. They're going to be resentful of lower-level or entry-level workers because their wages get compressed. Now, how long are we going to allow the Biden-Harris administration to blame other people for this stuff, for inflation and for wage shrinkage? I mean, they're blaming everybody but themselves. How long are we going to allow that? How long? And you know what else? This is a question I have. You know, given the numbers we're hearing on approval ratings, I mean, one said, what did I read? Let me pull this article back up just to the White House Council of Economic Advisors says they don't have the numbers yet for April. That's supposed to come out today. But inflation is basically at its fastest pace in 40 years. Now, a recent poll, only 23% of Americans rate economic conditions as somewhat good, and only 32% think things in the country are going well. 41% of Americans approve of Biden's performance, and only with 66% disapproving of how he is handling the U.S. economy. Yeah, my last question, how the hell are those numbers accurate? In some cases, how are some of those approval percentages that high? How do 41% approve of the job he's doing overall? No way. I am not buying that. The only one of those that I buy is the 66%. I mean, if 23% of people think things are going well, jeez. Or somewhat good, I'm sorry. 32% going well. Sorry. Okay, back to the NIL issue, and this really gets pointed up, and why you're seeing some of this furor over this. Pitt wide receiver named Jordan Addison. He's on the short list, as somebody says, of the best players in college football. But he entered the transfer portal recently. Last week, I guess it was. And the shocking thing isn't that he entered the transfer portal. The shocking thing is he's the Biletnikoff winner, which is the best college wide receiver. He also plays on a team that just won the ACC and played in a New Year's Six Bowl. And they didn't have a coaching change. Now look at, here's some people that have transferred recently. Caleb Williams, who started for Oklahoma, left for, Oklahoma for USC, where his coach, Lincoln Riley, took the job. Spencer Rattler, who Caleb Williams replaced, he left Oklahoma and ended up, I think, at South Carolina. And Jahmyr Gibbs, who was playing at Georgia Tech, their top running back, but they're on a losing team, so he left a losing program. Okay. That's great. Now, reports came out that a lucrative NIL deal was in play from USC for Jordan Addison. So it raised the specter of tampering. Many administrators said this is hardly the intended use of NIL. And NIL should certainly, it's one thing to use it as a recruiting tool, but to use it as a tampering tool, and that's what I'm saying. This has gotten out of control. Now, the NCAA coming in and starting the process of doing it is great. But there are people that are Hawkeye fans that are on Facebook or Twitter saying, you know, Kirk Ferentz needs to catch up. No, he doesn't. He's done things the right way. He didn't like the way things were happening, obviously. Why should he slot out a program and ruin the culture? I got news for you on this. Think about this. you're a junior or a senior and you've got a decent couple NIL deals for whatever, you know, and you've earned them. But now they're bringing in freshmen with 6- and 7-figure deals. I mean, some of these kids are going to be coming in earning more money than assistant coaches at the age of 18. Yeah, that's why people are worried about the state of college football and what could happen. But yeah, Jordan Addison, ACC champion Pitt, a somewhat major market, certainly in a Power 5 conference. But apparently USC came in with a huge NIL deal. And see, here's the problem. It's not the school doing it, because schools are not supposed to be part of the NIL process. You know damn well they are, though, through their boosters. But here's the, I don't know. Basically, as coaches are, the biggest thing with coaches and ADs, it's tampering. That's the problem. I mean, okay, how is tampering not the issue, I guess, is my thing. And maybe here, could we get a limit on transfers? I mean, I get that you get one free transfer and all that. But what about something that I've seen suggested? If a player leaves a school and gets a certain level, I'm not sure if there's a level yet, but if a player leaves a school for another school over NIL, maybe we should go back to making them sit out a year. Because if a kid says, you know what, if I got to sit a year and I'm not going to get my NIL for that year, then I'm not going. Well, then that tells you something. One, it tells you he's not putting academics anywhere close to first. And I'm not under any illusions that all these kids are putting academics first. But I think a lot of them are. And guess what? Those are the ones that aren't getting the big NIL deals. Remember, Sam Britt said on this show last summer, he's the father of Iowa lineman Justin Britt. He was not a big proponent of NIL because he said this is going to take kids that aren't team first, and it's going to exacerbate their selfishness. He's absolutely right, of course. Absolutely right. There's something's got to be more's got to be done. I think in addition to the booster and the collective angle, they ought to say if the kid's leaving with a certain size NIL deal, then he should sit for a year. If he can't sit for a year and the NIL deal has to sit on the sidelines, you know, if that can't wait, if the NIL deal can't wait and the kid can't wait, then maybe he needs to reevaluate. I've been pulling from American Liberty. Here's another one from them. The CDC spied on 20 million cell phones in a national COVID surveillance program. Newly released documents that show that they used data from tens of millions of American cell phones to monitor compliance with lockdown protocols. CDC purchased location data to determine if citizens followed curfew and tracked their movements to schools and churches. Agency also used it to closely scrutinize the effectiveness of lockdown policies on people living in the Navajo Nation. Now, Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin is the lead on this, holding them accountable, I guess you'd say. He sent them a letter. I actually have the text of it. Rochelle P. Walensky, MD/MPH, Director, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dear Director Walensky, a recent report revealed that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spent at least $420,000 to purchase location data from at least 20 million active cell phone users per day in an effort to assist the agency in monitoring Americans during the pandemic. According to that report, the CDC obtained location data from at least one company, SafeGraph, to examine activities in schools, places of worship, parks, grocery stores, and public transit stations, among others, reportedly wrote in a document, the mobility data obtained in this contract will be available for CDC agency-wide use and will support numerous CDC priorities. Says it remains unclear why the CDC tracked millions of Americans during the pandemic and whether it continues to do so. In response to COVID-19, the CDC should have been prioritizing the development of treatments, effective testing, and vaccine safety rather than tracking Americans' daily lives. To better understand the CDC's purchase and use of location data, I request your agency provide the following information no later than May 19th. Was, number one, was the CDC's use the only mechanism it employed to monitor Americans during the pandemic? Who at CDC approved the use and subsequent purchase of this data? What companies supply the CDC with location data? For each company, please indicate the years in which the data was provided to CDC and the cost. Number four, provide all records referring or relating to location data provided by SafeGraph or other companies. Five, provide all CDC studies or reports that relied on location data CDC received from companies including but not limited to SafeGraph. And number six, did CDC share location data with other federal, state, and local agencies? If so, provide what entities received the data and explain why. Well, one thing missing from his letter, did O'Biden sign off on it? He should have just asked that point blank. Not who, blah, blah, blah. He should have just asked right away, did President Biden sign off on this? And frankly, how is the specter of racism not raised here vis-a-vis Navajo Nation? Why was Navajo Nation a target or a subject of this? What about Navajo Nation required tracking? And when did all this start? Really, who in the White House or the media knew about it? What was the lapse between the implementation and the public awareness? I mean, seriously, why are we hearing about this now? Now, I know they're trying to ramp up COVID again. I think that's going to go nowhere, but you never know. But really, why are we now hearing about this? And frankly, why didn't Senator Ron Johnson direct the same letter to the O'Biden White House? Seriously, why not? I think it's a kind of important. From the Oops meets the Well file, we got this from American Action News on Senator Lindsey Graham. Yeah, newly released audio reveals Lindsey Graham praised Biden during the January 6th riots as the best man to lead the country. Oops. Newly released audio recorded during the tumultuous events of January 6th, 2021, have now revealed that GOP Senator Lindsey Graham praised Joe Biden as the best man to lead the country while crowds stormed the Capitol building. I love that, stormed. We will actually come out of this thing stronger. Moments like this reset, a somber Graham said from a secure location, according to audio obtained by reporters Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns and aired on CNN. Graham goes on to praise Biden. He'll be maybe the best person to have, right? I mean, how mad can you get at Joe Biden? He gave an impassioned speech on the floor when Congress resumed, told his colleagues to count me out of Trump world. Since then, obviously, he's returned to praising Trump for what he did during his administration. He's even been spotted golfing with him. Yeah, not a great look for Lindsey Graham. I would say, it's not going to help him down the road. I mean, should President Trump be reelected in 2024. I don't think Lindsey Graham is going to be or shouldn't be in the forefront of anything within a cabinet position. Okay, so we had a major upset last Saturday in the Kentucky Derby. 80-1 long shot, Rich Strike, charged up the rail in the home stretch. Second largest win ticket payout, a $2 win ticket, returned $163.60. Nice. He was only an alternate until Friday. On Friday, Dwayne Lucas pulled one of his horses, Ethereal Road, out of the race. Winning time was kind of slow, 202.61, as well off Secretariat's record of 59 and 2/5. That was back in 1973. The two pre-race favorites were Epicenter and Zandon. They were second and third. Yeah, given the shorter distance of the Preakness in 2 weeks, question is Rich Strike a threat to win it and maybe challenge for the Triple Crown? Doubtful, in my opinion. But it'll be an entertaining lead-up, and should Rich Strike win in Baltimore, we'll see a very interesting lead-up to the Belmont in 3 weeks. I just think a time that slow and to win down the stretch like that, I mean, to come, you know, the Preakness is a shorter race. It usually seems to be a tighter pack in that race. Yes, you do see comeback wins, but not the same way that you do in the Derby. Dopey Joe and the Strategic Petroleum Reserve from the Patriot Journal website, some info from here. After he drains one-third of the strategic oil reserves, price of gas remains at all-time highs. He promised to work like the devil to fix the gas crisis. He must have meant it, as they say, because only the devil would make a bad problem worse. Instead of removing limits to energy production, he depleted our gas reserves for a temporary and pathetically small drop in prices. And it's beginning a buyback process, the Department of Energy, with a call for bids to repurchase 60 million barrels of oil, or one-third of the 180 million emergency barrels released. Yeah, gas prices were already high. He's now scrambling to replenish those lost barrels, of course. Guess what? Prices are higher than ever. As of yesterday, $4.37 a gallon on average. Yeah, that beats the record of $4.33 a gallon back in March. They're going back to record highs. Do I really need to point out the stupidity and the futility of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve releases? I mean, again, note that since all this began, oil and gas prices are rising, not falling. Look, blaming Putin is fine, if largely unrealistic, but blaming non-producers as they did and blame the oil industry is even more typically O'Biden-esque. Seriously, leave it to those two to blame America for the problems that are actually created or manifested by the O'Biden regime. Seriously, here's a hint. Just because the oil leases are there or there are permits that were approved, it doesn't mean, after the way you hamstrung domestic production, it doesn't mean that companies will be that quick to jump in. You don't rush to produce, given the initial startup costs, when you don't have any confidence that you will be able or allowed to continue production. Going to take a quick break, and then we will come back with more of this rant. Last week, I had Brother Tommy and Hawkeye Mike on, so I wasn't able to play this tribute to one of our obits from last week, R.J. Parnell, who played Mick Shrimpton, Mr. Shrimpton, the drummer in Spinal Tap. Great song, a great video if you want to watch the movie. This is called Hellhole, and I will be back in about 3 minutes. Grab yourself some coffee or beer or wine or just water, whatever. Be right back, folks. Okay. We are back. I am Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Poly Sports here on Global Patriot Radio. You can find us at blogtalkradio.com. Seven shows over 7 days with multiple hosts on some days. And as I said before, hey, there's other shows too on Patriot Radio. Mondays, you got Vito and Al with the Vito Esposito Show. And Tuesdays, you got Eric with Cross and Crescent Discussion. Thursdays, Paul Sutliff with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, Conservative Casual Friday with Andrew Herod. And then Saturday nights, Usama Dakduk and Christie with Revealing the Truth About Islam. And then Sunday, Eric does come back with the real interfaith dialogue. Hey, welcome T. Bodie to the chat room. He says he feels great, all things considered. He's got an ice pack on his hip. Just got back from therapy. Just so you know, he had a little outpatient surgery, and he's doing good, though. He's recovering well. Good of him to come in here. So, okay, let's continue this rant about the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. Typically, when do you tap into reserves? Okay. When you have an actual shortage, when there is a disaster, natural or otherwise, that halts or severely impairs production or procurement, when you're at war, when demand far outpaces supply, or when you want to intentionally exhaust reserves and or have complete unlimited control of the petroleum supply. Now, put in terms of your own money, when do you tap into savings? Okay, when your checking account runs dangerously low and or income will be delayed or stopped for an extended period. Two, when you have catastrophic expense, a major home or car repair or actual destruction or a health issue. Insurance won't or can't cover the cost of repair or replacement or can't do it quick enough. That's when you might dip into your savings account. When you want to pay down debt and you know income will continue so that you can replace the amount from savings in a reasonable period of time. This is especially important when the cost of debt, i.e. interest, fees, etc., far exceeds what your money is earning. Number four, when you have excess savings and you can use those funds to earn more without excessive risks elsewhere, and it doesn't cost more. Or five, when you have a limitless supply of money. When do you not expend reserves? I'll tell you. When you are running low on said reserves, or when the amount you expend won't solve the problem or will have little effect. Example, you don't dump your last bucket of water in the ocean to avoid a drought. You don't do it when you can open up other avenues, such as allowing for increase in production and be reassured it will continue. You don't do it merely to shift the burden or the problem from one area to another, i.e. borrowing from Peter to pay Paul. An example, the idea that taking from your savings account to pay current expenses, while at the same time not adding to your current checking account, just shifts the burden from your checking to your savings, but it doesn't solve your cash flow problem. Now, another time, when the costs of replacing the savings or reserves grows exponentially. As an example, prices drop, President Trump added to and or replenished our nation's strategic petroleum reserve. The cost to do so, which rose as high as $4 a gallon during the previous administration, dropped to well below half of that. Plus, during the early months of the pandemic, demand was low due to remote workers and a slowing of business and travel activities. Now, it will cost more than it did during the Obama years, and government purchasing necessary to replace this will create supply and demand issues in the open marketplace. I can only come to one conclusion. O'Biden is doing this to intentionally disrupt the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the oil market in general, and hasten the crushing of the U.S. economy. On the latter, these fools believe that, one, they can get away with it and will make everyone dependent on and grateful for government control of our whole economy. Two, the American people as a whole will either willingly go along with it and or are too stupid to resist or revolt as it happens. That's what these people believe. Here's the thing. Given the poor poll numbers and the very likelihood of the GOP regaining control of both the legislative and executive branches in the next couple of years, it may just be the only move they feel they can make. With November approaching and general distrust of the election and electoral processes, they may just be right. I mean, even with big media and big left working overtime, the American people are going to be watching more closely with more interest. And they'll be much less willing to accept election fraud or the appearance of same. On top of that, a fully GOP legislature along with a Donald Trump or similar type of person in the White House come early 2025, parts of Big Left will be very vulnerable. And the person with the least to lose in that respect is Dopey Joe. Look, by January 2025, he will either be dead or he will more likely be completely incoherent and incompetent. Thus, any prosecution or punishment is just not going to happen. What if people like Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, even Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, not to mention former President Barack Obama? Are those people willing and able to face the possible consequences? Is a Mark Zuckerberg, as an example, willing to go to jail for his role in the 2020 fraud? Does Jack Dorsey walk away from Twitter precisely because each day off the board takes him further away from his or his company's misdeeds, not the least of which, again, may involve multiple levels of fraud? Now, I think that Big Left and those in the La Dopey Nostra know that trying to stabilize things juncture will be of no help in November. But in their minds, on the other hand, escalating things in Ukraine, maybe pushing China or even North Korea into economic or military attacks, decimating the Strategic Petroleum Reserve pretty much gives big media a path to try and tell us how martial law benefits us all. And by God, in their mind, it's better to be under martial law with La Dopey Nostra than it is under President Trump, which, by the way, was never going to happen. They kept trying to make us believe that, or as Sam Kinison says, believe that, takes the spotlight off the fact that those rioting outside the homes of certain Supreme Court justices, they're doing precisely what those people arrested for January 6th are accused of doing, attempting to affect the outcome of an official proceeding. Big Left doesn't think in those terms. But reality is, that's exactly what they're doing. And those are most of the charges that you're seeing leveled in January 6th are attempting to interfere with an official proceeding. That's what's happening when you're trying to influence a judge. So, yeah, I mean, I think they really, they don't see it as endangering the economy or endangering the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. They see it as it's theirs to control, and we just have to go along with it. And I think what's happened is that there are some that realize this is getting out of hand. We are going to lose in November, and if we lose in successive elections and lose the White House, some of us could be on the hook in an official capacity. We're finding out. It's still going slow, but we're finding out with the Durham investigations that, you know, the Clinton campaign and the Obama White House clearly attempted to interfere both pre- and post-election of Donald Trump in 2016. Well, you know, they could slow it down. They did slow it down under President Trump as much as they could by going after President Trump. But guess what? They have no one to go against now. They slow walk it. But guess what? Enough people are seeing that. Even idiots like Kevin McCarthy and Lindsey Graham, who put their feet in their mouths at record pace, even they know that, hey, look, if this goes well, we could put a hurting on some of these folks. Add this. Do you think Mark Zuckerberg is willing to take the fall by himself? That's clearly a rhetorical question because we know he's not. The one thing he is above all else is supremely selfish. Yes, he's egotistical. Yes, some of it is born of the I got bike racked as a kid. But he's selfish. And he thinks he's above it, you know, any law. Do you see him really willing to go to jail without rolling on other people? Hell no. The rate at which some of these people will talk, it will only be approached by the rate at which some of them get killed, Arkansided, as it were. So no, I don't, I think the whole, I think the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, I think was, originally I thought, you know, they're trying to get gas prices down for what? It's not happening. I mean, the total release, which is roughly 180 million barrels, is, I mean, the U.S. uses roughly 19.78 million barrels a day. So, you know, do the math. 180 million, I'm doing the math on my phone. Why not? Divided by 19.780. Yeah, they released 9 days worth of oil production, but now have to buy it back. And when they were first releasing it, oil was probably $90 a barrel. They're buying it back, and now it's dropped. You know, it was up to like 110, 115, 130 in some cases. But as Vito also points out, they were sending that some of that oil to other countries, European countries, because they were going to stop importing from Russia. Which makes more sense? Ramping up production and letting those companies sell it themselves, or taking it out of our savings account and selling it at a reduced rate and or giving it away? Well, I can't believe there's nobody in the administration in La Dopi Nostra that hasn't figured out the proper way, the first alternative, ramp up production, let American companies sell it. You know, everybody talks about, oh, Exxon's too rich. Nobody says anything about Exxon losing $20 million, or $20 billion, $22 billion, actually, in 2020. But guess what? When oil companies make a lot of money, they still pay taxes. Now, people say, oh, they don't pay. No, they may not pay taxes in the same way that individuals do. Everybody says, well, corporations pass the taxes on. Well, of course they do. Just like they do other costs. But they still pay taxes on profits. Now, this stuff of like people like Robert Reich, windfall profits tax, don't listen to those morons. It's idiotic. You bring those companies to the table, though, and you tell them ramp up production, it's going to mean increased taxes, but it's also because of increased revenues. But ramp up the production. But guess what? As I said before, those companies aren't going to ramp up production when in the back of their minds, you're dealing with an administration that is wholly dishonest, is wholly capable of rescinding that go-ahead to increase production. Yeah, not gonna happen so quickly. And they did make that point, wow, there's 9,000 leases or permits. Yeah, but they weren't developed anyway. But when you cut off other avenues, what's the point? I mean, there's got to be delivery and distribution. So, hey, back to the Derby real quick, and then I'll totally segue to something else. But before we get away from the whole concept, let's get back to the Derby. Here's the audio of it Vito has put on the dashboard here. If it'll...
A crown pride, then Epicenter is coming up on the outside. Epicenter has taken the lead as they arrive into the final furlong. Sandon is coming after him. Epicenter and Sandon, these two, stride for stride. Simplification down the outside is next. They're coming down to the wire. Epicenter, Sandon, Rich Strike is coming up on the inside. Oh, my goodness. The longest shot has won the Kentucky Derby. Rich Strike has done it.
Yeah, exciting call. And now again, I point out Rich Strike, $106 to $3 on a $2 ticket, second most ever. The most was Donner Girl, I think, in 1913. Something else, Rich Strike ran out of the 20 post, the very outside. Now, remember Brother Tommy said, don't put much stock in where a horse gets put. I mean, Zandon ran out of the 10 and finished third. But you know, coming out of the 20 hole. Now, again, the time, the slow time, it makes me wonder at the next level, you know, what happens at the Preakness. But it's exciting when something like that happens. I mean, in any of our lifetime, it's by far the biggest. It's cool to hear and see. And thanks to Vito for putting that on there, because that was awesome. I mean, here's what makes me wonder, though, about a Triple Crown. We've had a couple recently. In recent years, we had 2015 and I think 2018. But in those years, you didn't see the fastest times. Now, again, I'm comparing the Secretariat, but you know it's legit. I mean, if you're seeing record times, that's one thing. Then you're saying there's a real possibility, but a slow race like that, you tend to see more, I don't know, it's parity, I guess. I just think, you know, and now everybody's going to be gunning for that horse, of course, at the Preakness. Now, here's the one thing that I hope we don't see, and I think we've sort of gotten around or past it, but you remember a few years ago, you had horses that were skipping the Derby and skipping the Preakness. And then they come to the Belmont and try to take out a double winner to try and keep them from winning the Triple Crown. And I think that's wrong. I think we've gotten past that, especially since American Pharoah and Justify subsequently won Triple Crowns. But so I hope we don't see that. But I just think, you know, when you're in races like that, which is a, I don't want to say a plotter's race, but a strategic race, a strategy race, that tends to leave more room for anomalies and for, surprises, I guess. You're just not seeing horses that are just going out. Now, maybe these are just horses that just don't have that speed. Maybe it's because they're cracking down more on the doping. I don't know. Can't answer that. Brother Tommy probably could, but I think that may be some of it. But I also don't think that doping automatically improves times by 2.5-3 seconds. I just don't think that happens. So anyway, but great audio of Rich Strike. Just, it gives you the chills. It gives you the goosebumps. Okay. I wanted to do this. I know I've not talked much about the Hawkeyes. I've talked a little bit about draft and a little bit about some of the basketball and maybe transfers and everything. But I'll tell you something that's not getting talked about much in Hawkeye world. You're not seeing much on the main sites. You know, you go to the message boards. You're not seeing a lot of people tweeting about it. There's something really interesting happening in Hawkeye track and field. The Hawkeyes have won the last two Big Ten outdoor championships, 2019, which they won in Iowa City, and then 2021, which they won up in Minnesota, I believe. No, they're in Minnesota this week. They won it last year in where were they? Doesn't say. But anyway, they No, I'm not seeing where they won it. But anyway, they've won the last two. And they've also won the last two indoor championships on the men's side. But what you're seeing school records broken. You're seeing guys that are competing on a national level. You've recently seen the first time in several decades in 16 years, you saw the first time in 16 years somebody complete a sweep of the long and triple jump, James Carter Jr. for the Hawkeyes. You saw the Hawkeyes win a lot of relays at the Drake Relays. You've also seen a decathlete, Austin West, broke the 8,000-point plateau, which has never happened in Iowa, in the decathlon. Broke the Iowa school record, finished runner-up in Mount Sac Relays, which is a big, big meet, has top-notch guys there. You got sophomore 400-meter guy Genoa McIver. He's a two-time All-American and indoor 400 meter runner up at the outside at the Jim Click shootout on April 9th. He ran 44.74 in the 400 meters. That's borderline world class. He is now the fastest quarter miler in Iowa history. He came back in that meet to run a split of 43.8, anchoring the 4x400 meter relay. It's something it's kind of interesting. They are favored to win this weekend up in Minneapolis. You're really seeing, I don't want to say a dynasty, but you're seeing an Iowa track and field program looking to win its fifth consecutive conference, title meet, the last two indoor and outdoor champions. This, you don't see that in Iowa sports, other than wrestling. But in non-revenue sports, the Hawkeyes have never traditionally excelled. Now, in baseball, they've done well in recent years. They've made the NCAAs a couple of times. On the national level in track, they don't. No, they're not going out and setting the world on fire at the national level, because you got the SEC schools and the Southwestern schools and the Texas schools. But, you know, you're seeing them make a bigger dent than they have previously. You're seeing guys that are competing on the national stage. And that's kind of exciting, because, you know, Hayden Fry used to say one of the reasons Iowa didn't have the skill positions and the speed positions is because they didn't have the big track programs. Now, at the time, people said, well, yeah, neither did Miami. The University of Miami didn't have a track program at all. But they also locked down that part of the state. Well, locking down the state of Iowa doesn't usually mean much. So it means that Director Joey Woody is doing a great job recruiting. And when that happens, you're going to see guys across the sports spectrum. You're going to see more speed throughout the programs, whether it be football, whatever, baseball. It just means that they can get the better athletes. It means that good athletes are coming to Iowa outside of, you know, the traditional revenue sports, outside of wrestling. So Hawkeye fans, that should, you know, that's something you should take as exciting. And really, I don't know. To me, it's I ran track in high school, so I love track and field. It's my favorite Olympic sport, so that's why I like following it. And I'm really excited to see how the Hawkeyes do this weekend, and hopefully they'll take another title and then maybe do well at the NCAAs. So anyway, hey, another note. Starting in June, I'm probably going to move some of my shows to 5 o'clock versus 5:30. The reason for that is I am this summer, I'm helping a company as a paddleboard guide, and hopefully there'll be a lot of gigs, because it's something I love to do, but it's sort of a transition until I decide what I really want to do. Or maybe I'll just do it all along. Who knows? But it'll give me a chance to, as summer heats up, it'll give me an extra half hour of daylight. But the other thing is, it's the season to do some paddling in what's called bioluminescence. It's some kind of algae thing that happens, and you see like blue luminescent light in the water. And those paddles are really fun, and people really love going on them, including me. So if you see me start doing too many 5 o'clock shows, let me know. But I will be doing them a couple times, probably a month. I will be moving to 5 o'clock shows, and some of them may also be shortened, so that I can get out on the water earlier. I won't do it every week, but it'll be, you know, at least once or twice a month, just so that I can get out there, get on the water without being frantic about it. And in the meantime, we are winding down. That's it for tonight. But, hey, I really think things are turning a little bit in terms of conservative politics. I know we have a long way to go. We the people have a long way to go in terms of getting some of these leaders off their ass. But I see things turning. I think we're seeing that people understand that government itself is starting to just be a bunch of people that are protecting their own self-interest. And that's a good thing. We knock on the internet and how things travel so fast and you can't trust everything now. But in general, I think we're seeing a trend. I think people are starting to be wary of just accepting what government or media tells us. And that just because someone says they're conservative even doesn't mean that they're necessarily not preserving their own self-interest. And I think, we're coming up to a lull in college sports, certainly, but baseball, I'm not, you know, reporting or following it because of what they did last year, but it's exciting. You know, there's some exciting things happening. I was a no hitter last night thrown against the Tampa Bay Rays. You're seeing Shohei Ohtani, who is playing as both a pitcher and a position player and a DH. So that's exciting. And, you know, you got the NBA and the NHL playoffs that are winding down. So as that happens, we'll see more stuff happening. And then, of course, we're not that far away from when summer camps start up in both professional and college football. In the meantime, we're also 1 month away from Shellebration in Fort Dodge, Iowa. T. Bodie letting us know about that and him being in the chat room again tonight. So, hey, thanks for being here. I want to thank Vito and T. Bodie for being in the chat room. Sue and my friend Jeff for being on the phones and two numbers I did not recognize. I'm still wondering if those are the government spies that Vito has talked about. In the meantime, folks, have a great weekend. Have a great week. We will be back next week at 5:30. God bless. Good night. And we are out.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.